Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. Today, we catch up to what's happening in the state of New Jersey. Governor Phil Murphy, a Democrat, has now been in office 3 months, promising a stronger and fairer New Jersey. Murphy brought a progressive and expensive agenda to the State House and has been getting at times a rather cool reception to some of his proposals from fellow Democrats in the legislature. Turns out a millionaire's tax and legalizing recreational marijuana will not be slam dunks. And Murphy faces some huge challenges. The perpetually underfunded state pension plan is one. New Jersey's sky-high property taxes, another. That said, Murphy is moving quickly on issues like gun control, DACA, and climate change, reversing a number of former Governor Christie's policies. We'll discuss all this and talk about New Jersey's First Lady, too. Tammy Murphy is said to wield some clout behind the scenes. And we'll take a look at some of this year's congressional races with Bridget Harrison, professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. Welcome back to Radio Times, Bridget.
Thank you, Mary. Good to be here.
And Ryan Hutchins is Politico's New Jersey Bureau Chief. He joins us by Skype. Great to have you with us again as well, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
And here's the number to call to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let's begin with the big picture. What are some of Governor Murphy's more ambitious goals? Tuition-free community college is one, Bridget?
Tuition-free community college certainly is one. A hike in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Legalizing adult-use recreational marijuana was another. And there are a gamut of other proposals, including things like fully funding schools. Of course, most of these things, not all of them, will cost money. And so when we're talking about these policy ideas that may be able to attract a lot of support, the question is, will that support remain the same if it means tax increases?
Yeah, Ryan Hutchins, we're talking about over $1.5 billion in new revenue.
Yeah, that's right. It's about close to $1.7 billion in new taxes, and they're measuring it a little differently, about $1.5 billion, because, you know, they'd offset it with some, you know, an increase in, you know, the earned income tax credit, which is for, you know, working poor, middle class folks. There's also, an increase in a cap on property tax deductions on your state income taxes, but it's a lot for even Democrats to swallow, and they're the obstacle here, not Republicans. I mean, Republicans are like falling on the floor over these tax proposals. Yep. But it's Democrats that are the ones who are saying, well, hold on, we gotta talk about this. The biggest one is a millionaire's tax. It would impose a higher tax rate strictly on people who earn more than $1 million a year. That would produce about $765 million in revenue every year. And the governor, this is something he threw into his budget that he hadn't campaigned on and had even indicated he wouldn't do. He wants to roll back a recent cut in the sales tax to 7%, and that would produce about $550 million in revenue for the state.
So let's take a closer look at that so-called millionaire's tax first. There are two issues here. Will this prompt wealthier people to leave the state? Should it be enacted? And Governor Murphy did address that, I believe, in his inaugural address. And the other thing, Bridget Harrison, you know, Senate President Steve Sweeney, who used to be a supporter of this, is not so much these days.
Right. And we saw that right after the election. As a matter of fact, even I think before the Senate president and the incoming governor had spoke, the Senate president, Steve Sweeney, publicly said something along the lines of, we're going to have to rethink this millionaire's tax, particularly in light of the federal tax plan that reduced the deductibility of property taxes. So really kind of hurting people with property tax bills over $10,000, some of whom would be millionaires, essentially making New Jersey an extraordinarily more expensive state to live in, particularly for affluent New Jerseyans. And Sweeney's point was, you know, you have these revenue projections of about $760 or $765 million. if people leave the state, which people with that kind of income typically can, then one of the things that may happen is not only will you not get that $765 million, you may not actually get the income taxes that those folks are paying right now. Sweeney really succeeded in setting the agenda with the legislature really before Murphy was out of the gate on this, and it has developed a bit of opposition in the legislature. Remember, this was a rallying cry for Democrats throughout the Christie administration. They presented him with many bills that would tax millionaires that Christie vetoed, and now that they have a Democratic governor, I think that you're seeing a bit of hesitancy on the part of the Democrats in the legislature to enact this proposal.
So Ryan Hutchins, kind of picking up on what Bridget said, if Sweeney doesn't support this, how likely is it to win backing in the Senate?
Everything in Trenton is transactional. So, you know, we've got a couple months. The June 30th is the budget deadline. That's kind of where everything culminates, whether it's in the budget or not, you know, other big priorities. And there are a number of things that Sweeney is interested in. His number one priority, and you're going to talk more about this later in your show, is school funding. Yep. He disagrees with the governor or at least has. It seems like they're getting closer to a deal on how school funding should be distributed. And that's one place where he might be more interested in cutting a deal and giving some perhaps on taxes. He's tried to open up a compromise on a millionaire's tax. A week before the governor's budget address, he came out and went from saying we got to put the brakes on all taxes and rethink all this to, maybe we could try something with corporate taxes. They got a big tax break as part of this GOP tax legislation enacted this year, and maybe we could tap into a piece of that and actually give it back to people rather than taxing, millionaires, taxing individual income. The governor responded and said, well, maybe, it's not an alternative, but it's an interesting idea. Not the response you wanted.
Well, briefly looking at the sales tax, just briefly, cut back to a crazy number, 6.625% during negotiations a while back to raise the gas tax. Governor Murphy wants to bring it back up to 7%. That could bring in $581 million, but is there much opposition to this? How does this play politically, Bridget?
Boots on the ground, I am not sensing an incredible amount of opposition to it, simply because, unlike full percentage increases or decreases, a lot of folks in the retail sector think of this kind of fractional taxes being ridiculous and tough to calculate. And so, while it will increase revenues slightly, you're not seeing the kind of fomented opposition to this that you are seeing to some of the other proposals.
We are hearing from some of our listeners already. We've got an email from David who says, I believe this may explode in Murphy's face. I've been hearing mature workers in Jersey complaining in public about the moves Murphy's making that will raise taxes even more. It shows he's quickly raising the ire of voters. Well, at the same time, Ryan Hutchins, recently got, I think it was out of Monmouth County, a pretty fair rating from a recent survey done there, I think a 44% approval rate. So it's early days, but raising taxes, if it does happen in a rather grand way, if you will, might come back to bite him in a few years now.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
Raising taxes in a large way might come back to haunt him in a few years now.
Yeah, it could. I mean, and I think that's the worry of Democrats, by and large. I mean, Sweeney might be a different factor in that he's trying to put himself as kind of an opposition figure within the party against the governor, a check on him, but Democrats in general do seem concerned by the scale of these tax hike proposals. And, maybe if it was under $1 billion, they might be a little more receptive. But what happens if there's an economic downturn in the next couple of years, and what what happens if people just start to feel like this is too much and this is just being, you know, thrown on top of all the taxes they're already paying. Even if, you know, and Governor Murphy insists that this is how we cut sales taxes or cut property taxes is by increasing other taxes so we can, you know, inject some funding into important programs and into property tax relief. It's a gamble. I don't think the sales tax change is going to, you know, on its own, like, you know, shock people.
Well, it was at 7% at one point.
Right.
Right. And nobody noticed. That, yeah. Nobody noticed when it went down. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Unless you pay attention to what goes on in Trenton, you didn't know.
Yeah. Well,
and I think, Mary, an interesting thing to note about that Monmouth University poll that was conducted that you mentioned, while the governor enjoys a 44% approval rating, which is, you know, in New Jersey, it's a pretty decent number, a large swath of the population remains unfamiliar with him. And part of that has to do with the kind of noise that's coming out of Washington that manages to put everything else off the front page and off the Twitter feed. And so New Jerseyans, you know, may not be particularly aware of what is going on in Trenton. There is nothing that will capture New Jerseyans' attention more than someone trying to raise their taxes. Mm. And that is when I think many Democrats, particularly in the Assembly, who face re-election in 2019, are extraordinarily hesitant to go through and essentially acquiesce to Governor Murphy's agenda because they're on a different electoral timetable and they don't want to feel the brunt of the public's wrath 2 years before he has to face that electorate.
Well, another thing that might win voters' attention, Governor Murphy generated a lot of excitement on the campaign trail among at least proponents of legalizing recreational marijuana. He is for it. As governor, he's discovering, you know, easier said than done. Ryan, he's getting more pushback than perhaps he expected on this.
It's a little bit more. I mean, it's hard to whip the votes on something like this that people have, you know, got to spend a lot of time grappling with. And, you know, I think he thought he would come in and get it done. And he's still committed to doing it. He thinks that, you know, marijuana will be legal by the beginning of next year. He's counting on it in his budget for $60 million in revenue in the first 6 months of next year. So, I think they've got a lot of work cut out for them. The Legislative Black Caucus is holding a series of public hearings or held a series of public hearings on this. And, you know, it included some testimony that kind of, you know, skirted the line between, you know, accepted science and science fiction. And, you know, the leader of the Black Caucus, Ron Rice, state senator, is opposed to it.
Hold your thought there because we're coming up on a break, but we're going to pick up on this as soon as we have our break here on Radio Times. We've got Ryan Hutchins, the New Jersey Bureau Chief for Politico, Bridget Harrison, Professor of Political Science and Law at Montclair State University. And we are catching up on some of the big stories out of New Jersey this hour of Radio Times. Stay with us for more. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. We're talking about New Jersey this hour. The state's new governor is embarking on an ambitious new agenda, and we're kind of picking it apart this hour with Bridget Harrison, Professor of Political Science and Law at Montclair State University, and Ryan Hutchins, New Jersey Bureau Chief for Politico. And going into the break, we were talking about the fact that Phil Murphy is a proponent of legalizing recreational marijuana. It's not going quite as easily as he thought it would in getting the job done to get recreational marijuana legalized. And Ryan, you were alluding to the fact that some African-American lawmakers are leery of this. I think that the concern is that, especially in poorer neighborhoods, instead of opening grocery stores and restaurants and clothing stores, that's where the pot shops are going to land.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And State Senator Ron Rice, who leads the Legislative Black Caucus, has also expressed some much stronger and deeper feelings about you know, there are many African Americans and other minorities who are locked up in prison or in jail for, you know, for possessing or selling marijuana. And he just has a feeling that those people need to be released before we can even talk about, you know, a general making illegal for everybody. That should be the first priority before, you know, that everybody else gets it. And he feels like, you know, the people involved in the legislature and pushing this issue have you know, said, well, let's just legalize it and then we'll figure out, you know, what to do with the people already convicted.
Yeah. Well, Bridget Harrison, there's a push for decriminalization instead among some groups.
There is. And I think that you see an element of New Jersey's inherent sometimes form of conservatism. So it's a fiscally liberal state, but particularly in southern New Jersey, you see legislators who are hearing from constituents, particularly constituents over the age of 60, which is the demographic that is most likely to oppose legalization. And, you know, those constituents vote and they're telling their legislators, we don't want this. When you look at polling on this issue, there is a very clear gender divide. Essentially, almost everyone under the age of 35 supports legalization. And as the population ages, you know, when we move up through those cohorts, you see more hesitancy and reluctance. And in New Jersey, particularly where older voters are dominating, those legislators are responding to that. I think that one of the things that Ryan mentioned, the opposition of the Black Caucus in the legislature, I don't think that Governor Murphy anticipated that opposition. I think that his thought was that this would be a method of kind of rectifying some of the justice issues that were affecting the Black community. And, you know, I think that many people who were proponents of this anticipated that African-American legislators would support it. And when some of them, many of them are not, I think that was surprising.
So Ryan, if Governor Murphy, I think you said, is shooting to have this legalized by next year, you know, State Senator Nicholas Scutari has introduced legislation to legalize recreational marijuana. If a vote were held before the Democrat majority state Senate, tomorrow, I mean, what is the sense you think? Is it going to be as easy as the governor is hoping it'll be?
If they put up a vote, I don't think it would pass. I don't think they have the votes quite there. It's possible. You know, there's so many people who haven't taken a position. And that's, you know, that's a big part of this is people have to think it through. Apparently, you know, they haven't in recent years. They haven't come to a conclusion. And even the governor himself said this was a tough decision for him, that he has children, that he really wasn't for it. But then he heard about it as a social justice issue and thought about it in that framework and decided it was the right thing to do, that we had to legalize marijuana because so many people were being locked up, put in prison. And many of them minorities for possessing, you know, a drug that is legal in many states.
And practically speaking, it would bring in tens of millions of dollars to help with the budget.
Right. So you would figure, you know, if he's doing $60 million for the first 6 months of the year, you're talking at least $120 million for, you know, all of next year. And he's talked more about $300 million a year, which some people don't think it would be that much from that. But you'd have to work out the tax structure. There'd be additional taxes beyond the sales tax.
Well, okay, let's get to health care. We've got an email from Betty who says, we were very disappointed when Governor Christie, former Governor Christie, vetoed the New Jersey state option/exchange for the ACA. Now that we have a Democratic governor, we're looking forward to a New Jersey state insurance exchange. This is extremely important to those of us who are not yet 65 and eligible for Medicare and do not have the option of employer-based health insurance. So I was just reading in published reports this morning that legislation to create an individual mandate is awaiting Governor Murphy's signature. Bring us up to speed on this issue, Bridget.
Well, I think that this is one of the scenarios in which we see Governor Murphy really taking President Trump on, and he has been vocal in his support of the ACA. including the individual mandate. So while he hasn't come out and said, I'm going to sign this piece of legislation, I think most of us are assuming that he requested this legislation. It did pass in both houses. And essentially, this would make New Jersey be amongst the first states to essentially Trump-proof the repeals of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, this is certainly important to people like your listener. I think that this is also part of a larger political agenda in which Governor Murphy is attempting to position himself as the national opponent to President Trump's legislative agenda.
So what else, Ryan, has Governor Murphy done to become a thorn in President Trump's side? DACA, the travel ban, give us a short list if you would.
Well, so I'll just mention on Obamacare that one of his cabinet members testified before a legislative committee yesterday, you know, about this. Didn't say the governor was going to sign that statewide mandate, but, you know, it seemed to be heading in that direction. And that, you know, so the data shows individuals that are insured, you better stabilize the market. So they're thinking about that. They're reaching out to sponsors. He's done a number of things. He's tried to be quite the thorn in the side for the president and been tried to be vocal, you know, vocal about that. He's joined with, you know, with Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York and a few other Democratic governors from the Northeast on a number of issues, including probably chief of which is you know, this tax bill, this tax legislation that was enacted this year and the removal of limiting of a deduction for state and local income taxes. They call it SALT. And, you know, Cuomo, through his budget, just enacted some changes in New York, and Murphy is enacting a change that would allow people to do a charitable deduction in lieu of, you know, paying their property taxes or a portion of their property taxes, and that might be able to skirt a $10,000 limit on these deductions. So that's a big one.
Bridget Harrison, let's turn to Lieutenant Governor Sheila Oliver, no political neophyte, having served in the Assembly many years and at one point was the powerful Assembly Speaker. What have we heard from her in her first 3 months in office as Lieutenant Governor? What is her role in the Murphy administration?
Well, we knew that Sheila Oliver would take a different kind of role than her predecessor Kim Guadagno took. All evidence suggested that she and the governor had some serious conversations about what that would look like. One going in would kind of assume that much of her role would take place in terms of dealing with the legislature. That has happened to a certain extent, but not to the kind of overwhelming extent that you would expect a political neophyte like Phil Murphy to rely on someone who has, you know, a deep set of experiences in the legislature like Sheila Oliver. So there have been, some legislative whipping in terms of the people with whom she has good relationships with. We've seen some of that. We've also seen in her role as the head of the Department of Community Affairs some involvement in New Jersey's municipalities, increasing her statewide presence. Interestingly, many of the ceremonial functions of the role, which had really been performed almost exclusively by Kim Guadagno, Governor Christie's lieutenant governor, we've seen the First Lady taking it over.
So Tammy Murphy
has taken... Yes, yeah. And so Tammy Murphy has taken on a much more public and prominent role when compared to her predecessor, Mary Pat Christie, to the extent that she has, you know, she's had an office fitted out in the governor's office that has direct access to him. And oftentimes when you see press releases that are issued by the office of the governor, it will include Governor and Tammy Murphy, you know, today. I think there was one expressing sympathy at the passing of a legislator. And, you know, that is a marked contrast from Governor Christie's leadership style. So we see the lieutenant governor playing some policy roles, some legislative liaison roles, and some ceremonial, but not nearly the extent to which Kim Guadagno did.
What is your sense of Tammy Murphy's role? And in just kind of reading some articles, you know, some are apparently calling her a co-governor, and I don't know that that was necessarily meant as a compliment. And also, the governor caught some flack for spending $13,000 to renovate her office. Bridget?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with the exception of the $13,000, you know, I think that first spouses, the public really views that role quite fluidly, whether we're talking about, you know, first ladies of the president or in the governorship. I think that there's a lot of variation in how the individual takes on this role. And I think that the public is pretty tolerant of many different ways in which this can be accomplished. Tammy Murphy obviously is a very hands-on first lady. She's very interested in policy and politics and spends a lot of time by her husband's side. I don't think that New Jerseyans necessarily view that as a bad thing, but they don't like spending money on it.
Ryan, you want to weigh in?
Sure. So, you know, I think she's been deeply involved in actual policy. And you know, to what extent, like, she helps her husband decide, you know, what decisions the administration's going to take, what final decision, I'm not sure. But she has taken on a portfolio within the governor's office, particularly involving environmental issues and renewable energy, and was involved in discussions about this $300 million ratepayer subsidy for the nuclear energy industry in New Jersey that's been tied to some renewable energy issues.
Yeah. Let me get back to Lieutenant Governor Sheila Oliver for just a moment. I'd read that she worked with former Governor Christie to reform pensions, again, a perennial critical issue in New Jersey. And her work with Christie was sometimes an unpopular stance among many of her fellow Democrats. Do you see her, Ryan, taking a lead on pension reform in the Murphy administration?
I think that's possible. You know, we could see that happen. I mean, I think pension reform is a tough issue for this administration. They've established that they don't want to do anything that's going to aggravate the public sector unions, and they've. You know, but at the same time, they want to shore up this pension system, and this current path they're on of, you know, increasing payments, you know, by one-tenth every year might not be enough, especially if there's a downturn, if investments go sour. There's a real potential for some of the major public employee pension funds to become insolvent, and more needs to be done.
I think the system I read is $120 billion in debt. And Bridget, I think Governor Murphy on the campaign trail said that he would do his best to fully fund the pension system. And again, that's one of those things that's easier said than done.
Absolutely. And I think that this is one of the things. It is an incredibly sticky wicket. It is a complicated issue, and it requires the expenditure of a great deal of political capital just to get the unions to sit down at the table and negotiate. The reality is that pensions are essentially costing about $10 million a day in the amount that they are underfunded, and it is unsustainable. It will continue to negatively affect not just the amount of discretionary spending that the governor has to fund things like community colleges and the $15 minimum wage and that kind of thing, but also it has a negative bearing on our credit rating, which means it costs more to borrow. And so, you know, my thought was that this is the most pressing issue. It's not a sexy issue. It's not something that, you know, garners a lot of headlines. But in my view, this was the issue that the governor should have spent his honeymoon political capital on, getting some kind of committee together and starting these negotiations. But you see this very incredible tension because the governor relied very heavily on the public employee unions, as Ryan alluded to in his election, particularly the New Jersey Education Association, which also, as your listeners are probably aware in South Jersey, targeted the Senate president. And so you have this divide within the Democratic Party in the state, and it will present an impediment in trying to get a real pension reform that can be sustained by the state.
All right. And one more moment on Senate President Steve Sweeney. Ryan, how would you describe Governor Murphy's relationship, again, with the Senate president? Governor Murphy, this is his first time in elected office. Steve Sweeney's been around a long time at the State House. There's a little dust up this week over confirmation votes. Tell us about that, if you would, and maybe a misstep on Governor Murphy's part.
I would describe their relationship as very tense. I mean, I think some important context is that, you know, the Senate president really considered running for governor and was one of the three people, along with Phil Murphy and the mayor of Jersey City, who were the top contenders before, you know, everybody jumped in. And, you know, Murphy kind of cleared everybody out of the way, including Sweeney. And, you know, here is someone who's been in the legislature a long time. He's a powerful figure. And now he's really butting heads with the governor. And last week he decided to block the nominations of two nominees, both education nominees, and both of them African-American. And he, you know, he said he did this over school funding, a debate about school funding. But the governor responded by bringing up their race in a press conference, and Sweeney was shocked by the remarks. It was taken pretty widely to be, you know, injecting the issue of race into the debate. And you know, he said yesterday, the governor said yesterday, that he didn't mean to do that. But I will tell you that someone familiar with the administration's thinking had told me a day before the governor's remarks that the Senate president needed to explain why he was blocking the nomination of two black nominees. Mm.
All right. And he needs Steve Sweeney in his corner if he's going to get anything done. So we're going to, in just a moment here, we're coming up on a break. But before we say goodbye this hour, we are going to talk about some important elections this year. Senator Bob Menendez is running for re-election, and we've got a couple of congressional races that are important. So we're going to get to those in just a moment. Ryan Hutchins is New Jersey Bureau Chief for Politico. Bridget Harrison, Professor of Political Science and Law at Montclair State University. You're listening to Radio Times. Again, our number to call if you want to join us, 888-477-9499. Feel free to tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And for the next few minutes, we'll be checking in with Bridget Harrison of Montclair State University, Ryan Hutchins of Politico, regarding some congressional races. Bridget, Senator Bob Menendez running for re-election and uncertainty just a few months ago.
Yes, and from the most recent polls that we look at, it looks like the senator is in very good shape. He does have an opponent, a pharmaceutical CEO, Robert Hugin, and despite the fact that he has attracted what many would deem credible opposition, there is the sense that, particularly given awareness of the closeness of the U.S. Senate and Democratic control at stake, many people, I think, in New Jersey are just willing to back Bob Menendez. It doesn't look like he's going to have the uphill battle that many thought that he might have a year ago.
Yeah, and Ryan, you know, there's a picture of Senator Menendez when he announced he's flanked on one side by Governor Murphy and the other by fellow Senator Cory Booker. So the message was loud and clear there.
Yeah, I mean, immediately after his corruption charges, the final charges were thrown out, it was made extremely clear by the establishment and the Democratic Party in New Jersey that they are 100% behind him. And for the most part, nobody had really left him throughout a 2.5-month trial. And his poll numbers fell, obviously, after weeks and weeks of testimony. But this latest poll on this specific race has him up 21 points over his Republican rival. So he appears to be in pretty good shape. That was a Monmouth University poll from last week.
Okay.
So and Mary, if I can just add in there, the thing about that poll that is interesting is it means that Republicans nationally will not be investing in the state of New Jersey because they're going to view it as not winnable. Instead, they'll be diverting resources to some of the open seats that we'll be seeing and some of the congressional races. But if the candidate is up by 20 points, chances are they're not going to be spending millions of dollars on behalf of their nominee here.
All right. So, Bridget, we only have about a minute left here. In the House of Representatives, two longtime New Jersey Republican incumbents are throwing in the towel this year. Frank Lobiondo, Rodney Frelinghuysen, who happens to be the chair of the powerful House Appropriations Committee, each has served over 20 years. Why have they said they're stepping down?
I think for different reasons. I think that Congressman Lobiondo essentially, I think, kind of got tired of both the Trump administration and kind of the divisive politics in Washington. Frelinghuysen, on the other hand, it seemed to me he has attracted a pretty attractive competitor who has been able to raise considerable amounts of money, named Mikey Sherrill. She was a former Navy pilot, and it looked to me as if Frelinghuysen looked at the numbers and thought that this might be an election that he might not be able to win, and so decided to bow out.
So, and Ryan, those districts now might be in play?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, in Lobiondo, in the second district, that's a very interesting race because they've got State Senator Jeff Van Drew. He's probably the most conservative Democrat in the state legislature, who's pretty much a shoe-in for winning the seat, and all the, you know, the liberals have been left on the sideline there, are a shoe-in for winning the Democratic nomination. I think that the vast majority of these seats, are in play, and there's some polling to suggest that everyone could potentially, go Democrat.
All right. Ryan Hutchins, thanks again for joining us for Radio Times. Ryan is New Jersey Bureau Chief for Politico.
Thanks for having me.
And Bridget Harrison, great to have you along, Professor of Political Science and Law at Montclair State University. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Mary.
Okay, so turning to the Camden School District, Camden School Superintendent Payman Rohanifard says he is stepping down after 5 years at the helm. The troubled school district has made progress in that time, but there's still a long way to go. And joining us for a close look at this latest news out of the Camden District is John Mooney, NJ Spotlight's education reporter. Welcome back to Radio Times, John.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Rohanifard's decision was frankly unexpected by many. You know, the district, again, has been making some notable progress. What are you hearing? Why the decision to step down now, even as I believe he's got another year on his contract?
Yeah, he there's all kinds of rumors floating around. The way he terms it is it was time for him. He had been here for 4 years, four-plus years. A new administration was coming in. He really felt for the district. He felt for the district to take the next step. It needed some new leadership. He wanted it to be Camden leadership. There's also some personal things going on in his life with his wife about to get a doctorate, or she's a postdoctorate fellow at UPenn, and he just had a second child. But no doubt there's also a new governor in place, Governor Phil Murphy, who has been lukewarm, to say the least, about state takeovers, and I think he was probably likely to take some actions on it. Whether he would replace Rohanifard or not, I'm not sure, but it was uncertain. So I think there was a bunch of things that came together, and it's a really interesting time for this district. I mean, they have made some gains. There's certainly the growth of charter schools and Renaissance schools has changed very much the face of the district, and it'll be interesting where it goes from here, for sure.
Well, let's talk about some of those changes. First of all, if you could, John, just give us a brief synopsis of what Renaissance and charter schools are, as opposed to public schools.
Yeah.
Renaissance is kind of what it's like, a charter public hybrid. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I've called it a few different things because it is a little confusing. It's charter schools are privately run schools on public money. They are chartered by the state. They are, typically locally born, but can be run by larger charter management organizations. What is a little different, Renaissance schools are similarly run by charter management organizations, and you'll be familiar with one of them notably is Mastery Schools, mm-hmm. Out of Philadelphia, run several in Camden, and then the other two are KIPP and Uncommon Schools. What is different about them is they are a bit more beholden to the local district, and they have some more freedoms in that sense, but they also have to follow basically the enrollment patterns of a local district. So while charter schools can enroll kids from throughout Camden into their schools, at least the intent of Renaissance schools is they're meant to be neighborhood schools to draw students from specific neighborhoods to be part of the enrollment system of the district. So they are also, though, with that comes some more freedom. They, unlike charter schools, they have greater leeway to use public money for public facilities. A lot of them in Camden are using public or former district schools and converting those.
Mm-hmm.
So, there are pluses and minuses to that, but I often call them charter district hybrids, but they mm-hmm. are run by charter management organizations for sure, and three very big ones.
So, John, while Ruhan Affordable, and he's actually still the superintendent. I think he's leaving at the end of the school year.
Right.
But since he began his tenure, the number of public schools, I believe, has dropped from 26 to 18 in Camden. And at the same time, you see there's an improvement.
District schools, you mean.
District schools,
right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time, you see an increase. You see some improvement in, say, proficiency in English to 11.5% of students, to proficiency, in math, to proficiency in English to just over 15.5%. And those are from some very low numbers. Considerable improvement, but as you point out in an interview you did recently with Ruhan Affordable, that's still 4 out of 5 kids reading or doing math below grade level. What was his response to that?
Yeah, and he is quite open to the fact that they have a long way to go, and there's certainly it was interesting how he responded to that. Is he didn't speak so much to those results, although he did, acknowledge there's a long way to go. He did raise some questions about the testing, which was interesting. It sort of went in a tangent that I didn't expect, where the value of that. And he spoke to, he said, assessments are important. They're important in engaging systems, not so much individual students. And he talked a lot, and it was interesting, we got into this conversation. I asked him one of his biggest surprises in getting into this job, and he had come from New York City and Newark, but Camden, has faced its, a mountain of challenges over the years. And he talked a lot about the social and emotional health of and physical health of the students. He's and the real issues that are happening in Camden that affect the kids' schooling. And it goes, everything from, obviously the poverty, but nutritional issues and family issues and crime, and how he really it struck him how it's really the school's role to take care of a lot of those issues even before they can start talking about the instructional. And that's a lot of pressure on these schools to get up their test scores and the like. But he said, when I have an opportunity to spend money or to add programs, it's around mental health issues. It's around student support. It's not necessarily around teachers. And it was interesting. It was, it's very true. There's no doubt about it. He referenced how in his tenure he's been to 8 student funerals. And as he added,
that's not
even all of them.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't quite answer my question on instructional levels and achievement levels. He did say, and this is notable, that their dropout rates have been cut in half, and that's significant.
So what does he attribute that to?
Well, again, it's a lot of those social and emotional supports, keeping kids in schools, working with their families. I will give him a lot of credit. This is a guy who really got into the community in that first year, especially, and continues to, but he really did in that first year. I'll contrast it to where he came from in Newark, which a lot of the same policies, to be honest with you, but and if your listeners are familiar, there was a lot of tumult around Newark and the Mark Zuckerberg money that came
sure.
in. Yeah. They had a very controversial superintendent named Cammie Anderson, who Paymount had worked for, and she had not taken that first step when she tried to implement these reforms of going out into the community and selling it. And it was much more of a hammer approach. He did, and he took a year to really get out there, listen to folks, sell his ideas, and indeed when it was time to implement them, a year into his tenure, much easier time, not face nearly the kinds of pushback that she did. And it's to his credit. He ended up being a coach on the Camden High School basketball team, very active in the community. And that, I think, deserves a lot of credit.
So John, we don't have a whole lot of time here. Was that social and emotional support you spoke of for students more present in resident Renaissance / or charter schools as opposed to district schools?
Well, I think I'm
saying this. The Camden Education Association Union President Keith Benson says, quote, "It feels like the last 5 years have been like the Hunger Games for school resources. Public schools," that's his phrase, "have been starved to grow Renaissance schools." So is more funding going there to provide this sort of support?
Yeah, well, one of the things that is notable about charters and specifically these Renaissance schools is they do have some resources that the local district doesn't have. They also have some requirements that the local districts, they don't have some requirements that the local districts do have. So I think this has come up in other cities in New Jersey, there's more freedom to get money into the classroom, in the charters and the Renaissance schools than there were in district schools. And whether those monies into the classroom mean teachers and supplies or those emotional supports. I will say, and I know all three of these organizations, Mastery among them, and really a very strong one, they are very good about working with families and community. And with KIPP and Uncommon, they're following these kids after they graduate to make sure they make it through college. I mean, that's really one of the strengths of these programs that district schools, some have learned from, but others, you know, there's other impediments and challenges. So I wouldn't say uniformly that the charters and the Renaissance schools are doing these things, but I think that they do build a community. They're typically also smaller schools. They build a community that keep the kids in. And it goes a long way.
Do you see what Payman Rahanafard, I guess, has gotten rolling? Do you see that continuing under his successor? Go ahead.
Yeah, he is somewhat named who he wants. Well, not somewhat named. He's named who he wants to be the successor. Katrina McCombs, one of his assistant superintendents from Camden, went to Camden High School, was a teacher, a principal. He has put her name forward quite bluntly. It is not his choice by any means, and it will be up to in this case, Phil Murphy, the governor, will make that selection and his education commissioner. I think a lot of this stuff will continue. I don't know. You know, there. Back to that point, we still have 4 out of 5 kids in his district schools that aren't succeeding. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on raising that. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I don't think. Some warning for Camden residents. I mean, in Newark and Jersey City and Patterson, 3 other takeover districts, it was 20, 30 years before the state got out. I don't think that's the case in Camden, because I think we're very, you know, policymakers are very cognizant of that long and very checkered history of state takeovers. But it's going to be a while longer. And how Phil Murphy, you know, this is in his hands now. Payman Rahanafard was Chris Christie's appointment, and now you know, it's really going to be up to Murphy to put, you know, make that next imprint, whether he picks Katrina McCombs or whoever.
And I think I heard you say earlier that Murphy is not necessarily a fan of state control.
No, he has been outspoken against it, and actually has raised the issue of it being aimed at predominantly minority school districts and you know, some of the issues that arise out of, you know, the state control of these districts, while there's some predominantly white districts that face a lot of the same challenges that haven't seen some of these interventions over the years. This is more of a historic issue. But he has said that it's time for the state not to be telling these, you know, these districts how to do their job. But at the same time, in a place like Camden, where they had, you know, such troubles and such dysfunction in the school district, to not act on that, you know, also has some, you know, some real repercussions.
So, John, got to stop you there because we're out of time. John Mooney is education reporter for NJ Spotlight. We could have gone longer with this. Thanks so much. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens with assistance from Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us for Radio Times.